Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Every 4 years, as the political campaigns bitterly rage, a group of top officials from the sitting administration and the candidate challenging the presidency work methodically to ensure a smooth transition of power that has characterized America's highest office since the founding of the Republic. Joining us today are two men who have been intimately involved in the defense side of every presidential transition for more than four decades. Michael Baer is the chairman of the Defense Business Board. He's also the president of the Dumbarton Strategies Consultancy, and Arnold Panaro, a former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who is now the chairman of the Panaro Group Consultancy and the chairman of the National Defense Industrial Association. Michael is a retired U.S. Army Reserve Colonel, and Arnold is a retired Reserve Marine Corps Major General. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vago.
Thank you, Vago. Great to be here.
Absolute pleasure having you both on. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Bell, Beretta USA, and Leonardo DRS sponsored our coverage of AUSA Now, the Association of the United States Army's annual meeting this year, presented virtually. Arnold, let's start with you. You were staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee, worked very, very closely with the legendary chairman, Sam Nunn, the Democrat from Georgia, and a Coast Guard veteran. The campaign has just a couple of days left to go, but the transition folks from the administration, as well as the Biden team, have been hard at work for some time. All of this is governed by a pretty tight schedule. And as government has become more complex, the whole challenge has become more complex in order to ensure a smooth transition. Talk to us about what both sides are doing right about now and how the process has evolved over the centuries, in fact.
Well, Vago, it's important to maybe get a little history lesson here from the first inauguration, which was in April of 1789. And the transition team that worked before that inauguration was George Washington, Alexander Hamilton, and Henry Knox. Obviously, Washington would be the president and the other two would be in the cabinet. And they basically transitioned, consisted of having tea in the afternoon at Federal Hall to plan. And frankly, that was the nature of transitions for about the first 150 years of our government. And it was really trusted advisors, small handful. And then in 1938, the inauguration was moved from April to January 20th, and more elaborate transitions started being put in place. And then the modern transition, as you indicated, the complexity of government, the number of issues they have to deal with. The Presidential Transition Act of 2010 made government-supplied space and resources available to the candidates right after the convention. And, you know, to talk about the various activities, I think Michael Baer is a real expert on this, and I would defer to him at this point.
Thank you, Arnold, and thank you, Vago. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'd also start with a little bit of context, and that is, The two bookends that matter here are the presidential election, which will occur in November, and the midterm, which happens 2 years later. Most transitions focus in that window. Why the midterm? Because the party in power in the White House has over time, there have only been three exceptions, 1934, 1998, and 2002, the party in power at the presidency lost significant seats in the House of Representatives on many years. So a lot of attention is paid in terms of what goes on in order to create a significant change that validates the election and avoids that midterm sacking. So what occurs is really policy decisions for the new team, the what will happen, implementation planning, the how they'll do it, the selection of the new team, the new presidential appointees, the onboarding of those appointees, getting them confirmed, building out their staff, And lastly, orienting the newly appointed members into the job. That's the scope of what occurs in the transition.
Arnold, I want to go to you because, schedule, this is all about schedule. And there are very few people in Washington that are better than the two of you in always scoping out how much time there is on legislative calendars, how long clearances take. Talk to us a little bit about the rigidity of the calendar to make sure that the right offices are cleared and that by January the 20th, right? I mean, even though the Bush administration was delayed by more than a month because of vote counting until George W. Bush was declared the winner, the process was ongoing. And both of you, as I recall, then were deeply involved in it so that at least cabinet secretaries would be seated as of noon on January the 20th. Talk to us a little bit about the schedule and what's got to happen to make sure that all of this happens right from the obligation of folks up on the Hill, but also the obligation of the two transition teams.
So there, Vago, there are four main tasks that are going to face the transition team, and I'll list those in just a second, but all the key decisions that have to be made on policy implementation, which means you've got to translate your campaign slogans and promises into policy. They're going to conduct an agency review. They're going to assess the work of over 100 plus federal agencies, their workforces, and the issues that are in those agencies. You've got the issue of the presidential appointments. You've got to identify, vet, and deal with over 4,000 political appointees and 1,200 that require Senate confirmation. And then you've got to basically be ready to set up and run the new government. And you have basically 78 days to do that. So from the election, on November 3rd to the inauguration on January 20th, all that has to be done in 78 days. And furthermore, for the senior cabinet and the sub-cabinet, most administrations, whether it's a reelected president or a new administration, they want their key people and new cabinet members. And President Trump has already signaled he's looking at major changes. If it's Biden, 100% of the people are going to turn over. They'll want all that done on January 20th. So the Senate will have to be basically doing confirmation hearings when the new Congress convenes on January 2nd. And that new Congress could be, a Democratic House and a Republican Senate, or a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate. And that will have an impact on the schedule. So there is a tremendous amount, as I indicated, that has to get done in really the next 78 days.
And what's the communication between that transition, right? So depending on what happens on the 3rd, how soon is the transition office of the winner, let's say it's Biden, at what point are they communicating directly with the Hill in terms of, right? Because I mean, some of the key people, there's a sense on who some of the key cabinet secretaries are going to be. How does that happen when Congress is out of session in terms of making sure everything is queued up so that it's ready when the members reconvene?
So Michael can comment on this too, but let me just say, Vago, in terms of people speculate about who might be the cabinet, I have a term that I call the great mentioner, because there's always tremendous speculation, and it's the same for Trump reelected or Biden elected new, about who might be the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State or the National Security Advisor or the head of EPA or the head of DHS. And history is pretty replete with the people that get mentioned, because the people that talk, they don't really know. And the people that know, they don't really talk. And in fact, 11 in the last 40 years, 11 of the 13 people nominated for Secretary of Defense were surprises, not the ones that people speculated before the election about who would get it. So, but they will be the head of Biden's transition is Ted Kaufman, his former administrative assistant when he was a senator, and then the U.S. senator. He took Biden's place when he was elected vice president till there was an election. They'll have a legislative team. They'll have people that basically specialize in the confirmation process. They will identify what we call Sherpas, people that will guide whoever's going to be the nominee of getting ready for confirmation. They'll work with the committees of jurisdiction, whether that's the Judiciary Committee, the Foreign Relations Committee, the Armed Services Committee. And then there's a tremendous amount of paperwork that has to be filled out. Technically, a new president can't nominate anybody until January 20th. And what happens then is after the president is sworn in, if it's Joe Biden, he goes over to the president's room right off the Senate floor and he signs the paperwork for all the people he's going to nominate that day. Let's take a Secretary of Defense like Jim Mattis. President Trump nominated Jim Mattis right after he was sworn in on January 20th. The Senate confirmed him that afternoon because they had already conducted the hearings in early January. So Michael has been very involved in this as well over the years. And Michael, I know you'll want to add something here.
Yeah, thank you, Arnold. Because in addition to communicating with the Hill, the transition team, once there is a victor declared, will begin to communicate, according to the statute, with the executive branch. There will be people, there are people in the challenger's team who have been submitted for clearances and at the appropriate time will get access to classified information. And plus, they'll be able to make formal requests to the administration in power to provide them background information on budgets, personnel, policies, plans. That process set in law with the Modern Transition Act really helps make this transition a little smoother. It's also important to note that that occurs on the part, in this case, that will occur in the Biden team up and until and only until he's declared to have lost the election. And so the concern about whether or not the delay in the formal decision as to who won might interfere with the transition is a little off point, because in Arnold's experience and mine, those transition teams are generally very well run, very focused, and they don't get distracted by external events, because they know no matter what, on January the 20th, they're going to be in charge and they have to get their president's team ready to go.
So one other deadline that they face is the president gets inaugurated. Now, again, if it's Trump's reelected, even though there'll be another inauguration, their budget process will continue. And of course, all the cabinets have been working on guidance from OMB for domestic discretionary as well as defense discretionary. But let's say it's a new president. The budget is supposed to be sent up, you know, the first week in February. Now, and typically, there's no way you can basically put a $4 trillion budget together between January 20th and the early weeks in February. So that's one of the things transition teams, if it's Biden is elected, they will spend a considerable amount of time during these 78 days looking at what they're going to submit in terms of budgets. They'll have to decide how much of a deficit they want to have, how much for domestic discretionary, how much for defense discretionary, how much on mandatory spending. Do they have any major tax proposals that would affect revenues? All that has to be worked on during these same 78 days. At the same time, these landing teams that go into the various cabinet spaces to basically get firsthand information from the people that were there in developing, you know, personnel choices, looking at budgets, looking at policy in the Department of Defense. You know, the questions are going to be, right, you know, what's our policy to China? What do we do about North Korea? All that has got to be dealt with in a very compressed period of time.
Bago, let me just add one other really important thing that happens, and particularly relevant in the Department of Defense. And that is that the incoming team has to select which appointees of the current team they wish to hold over as they're fleshing out their administration.
Right.
In the Department of Defense, there must be a Senate-confirmed presidential appointee in each of the three services and one at OSD. Now, the president can move people in, but the president in power can move some people in. But generally what happens is the transition team likes to have 5 to 6 people that they'll hold over in order to have bodies in seats as they build out their team. Arnold, in my experience, is that the very best of administrations by July the 1st, so 5 months later, the very best of administrations have at most half of the Department of Defense appointees, that is 30 of the 60, actually confirmed and in seats.
Right. Let me, Michael, start with you on this question, and Arnold, get your sense. Michael, you went through this process. You were a senior Commerce Department official during the Reagan administration. What And Arnold, you obviously served with one of the great Democrats who was in the seat and defense leader of the First Order. What makes a successful transition? What makes an unsuccessful transition?
In my mind, the most successful transitions are the ones that link the what, the policy decisions, to the how, which is actual detailed planning about what's going to happen day one through day 700 of that first 2 years, and people. It's often said that people are policy, but policy only gets happened, only occurs if you've really got a focused plan that attends to the highest priorities of the president that's been elected. Unsuccessful transitions in my mind are those that try that have 12 high priority items or 20 high priority items, and those all get lost in the noise. So it is really all about tight focus and linking policy, implementation, and people. When that happens with a really strong transition lead, then I think the administration is ideally set up for success.
Arnold?
If I go, in my view, there are two sides to a transition. There's the outgoing and the incoming. And the ones that are most successful is when the outgoing basically looks at it from a good government perspective and says, okay, the American people have spoken. We want to make sure the government is in good hands. We want to make sure the new president gets off on the to a good start. We're going to be working very carefully and responsibly with the incoming. And on the incoming side, the most successful is when they're humble, when they don't basically come in with a chip on their shoulder and think, okay, these people have screwed it up for the last 4 years and now we're here to fix it. Because particularly a place like the Pentagon, extremely complex, extremely difficult, extremely broad in scope. And so if the two sides basically are willing to work together in a good government perspective, those are the most successful. Michael and I have seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. And the ugly is when both sides basically are not looking at it from a good government perspective. And the best has been people that basically take it seriously and understand that they have an obligation under the law and to the country to make a smooth, peaceful transition work. And so you would hope that would be the case. And with the Pentagon is always forward leaning in the foxhole for the most part. But I mean, we've seen some times when it hasn't worked as well.
Yeah, very, very well said, Arnold. Very well said.
Let me ask you this. I mean, and I don't mean this at all politically, but I mean, we have for the first time in the last 224 years since the second, at the end of the second Washington term, that a president is saying that he may not go, irrespective of how the people might vote. Does that present any challenges in the transition planning process? I mean, does that sort of become sort of arranging deck chairs on the Titanic at some point, not to put too grave of a parallel on it?
So, Vago, I actually think that if a transition team spent a second thinking about that, it would be wasted time. Their job is, as Arnold said, to focus on standing up the next administration, not getting into the legal hurly-burly about how and when that might occur. That requires every single minute of those 77 days. And they also have to get ready for something we haven't talked about, which is historically in the first 270 days of an administration, from Eisenhower forward, there have been significant national security challenges that occurred in those first 270 days. And as we pointed out earlier in this conversation, at defense, state, Treasury, Commerce, and the rest of the agencies, rarely by that in within those 270 days is an administration even half built out. So the need to think clearly and crisply about what's going to happen, who's in the room, who are the advisors, making sure that that there are clear responsibilities and delegations of authority while a government is in part being assembled is really important. A transition team that takes their eye off of that really, I think, malserves their president-elect. Over.
And in the Pentagon, there's going to be a major part of the Pentagon that won't be in transition at all, and that's the senior military. All the service chiefs are relatively new. Most of the combatant commanders are relatively new. They're going to respond to the military chain of command independent of any legal battles. You know, the president is the president till January 20th. And if Trump gives a legal order to the Secretary of Defense and he to the combatant commanders, that's the chain of command. They're going to carry it out. They're not going to be, the military is going to be continuing to march in their duties to organize, train, and equip under Title 10, the combatant commanders to operate in the field to make sure that we protect American citizens at home and abroad. And in the Department of Defense, and I would say Ted Koppen, who's running the Biden transition, he's worked in the Senate, he's been a senator. A lot of the people in the national security area that we've seen in the newspaper that are advisors are very experienced individuals. As Michael said, they're going to keep their head down and spend those 78 days doing what they need to do should he eventually be named the president, because at some point we're going to know. So I don't think they're going to pay. That'll be handled by people totally separate from the transition team. And the other thing is, you know, the Department of Defense is basically a good government outfit, no matter who runs it. And so I would say on the receiving end, the outgoing, if they are outgoing, they're going to be very responsible, too. So I don't see the legal fall to roll, if there is any, and let's hope there isn't. Let's hope the American people, it's clear what their, you know, druthers are. I think the Pentagon in the transition relative to the Pentagon, whether it's to a reelect or to a new president, will go relatively smoothly.
Let me ask one last question. What are the implications for actually not filling jobs fast enough? We've seen after administration sort of start but not fully fill out all of its jobs, right? One of the criticisms, and I know this is something that's very important to you guys, given how important the political appointees are in our process, right? I mean, the organization itself has a tendency of marking time when you don't have those senior civilians that are giving guidance. What are the implications when an administration starts off with not a full deck or even less than a full deck and is taking a year to fill positions? What are the negative implications? Michael, start us off.
So, thank you, Bago. I think it's a really important point, is that these jobs are so important in the national security arena, and particularly in defense. Often recognized, the Department of Defense really isn't a cabinet entity. It's really a nation all to itself in terms of its complexity, size, and scope. But most importantly, if every day lost with an appointee, when now we're seeing that the average appointee spends about 2 years in a job before they depart or go up. So in that case, the need to get your team established promptly and make sure you have succession planning already from the beginning. Whoever you pick as Secretary of the Navy, you have to make sure who's the person who you have in mind or multiples to succeed them. And then again, so in that case, the deputy assistant secretaries, ironically, are almost as important as who you pick for the very top jobs in Navy, Air Force, and Army, as an example, or the undersecretaries at defense. Because we've seen throughout an 8-year administration, people can literally move from deputy assistant secretary through assistant secretary up to under. So building a bench that quickly and in depth that has succession planning built into it is really essential for success.
One of the challenges I see is, as mentioned before, if Biden is elected president, you're going to have 100% turnover, maybe not initially, but 100% turnover of the political appointees, particularly in the Pentagon, of which there's 60. A reelected president, the statistics are very clear in the second term, you have a turnover about 2/3 of the political appointees. So either one is going to have during the transition the goal to basically fill a lot of key, extremely important positions in the administration. And one of the challenges we've had in recent years is, starting with President Kennedy, the amount of time between nomination and confirmation has gone from about 3 to 4 months to get all the key people on board to, in the Trump administration, it ended up being 11 months. Mattis got confirmed on January 20th, but the next 3 or 4 key people didn't show up till May 15th. Some of that was a slowness in terms of the administration nomination. Some of it was slowed down by procedural hurdles in the Senate. But in Obama, he got his key people in the Pentagon on board in about 4 months. Trump, it was about 7 months. And so really, you can't leave these key positions vacant for that period of time. So there needs to be an agreement to get these people vetted and nominated quickly. And there needs to be an agreement in the Senate to process them on a more accelerated basis.
One very last quick question. There's some discussion that President Trump, whether he wins or loses, may want to make a change at the Defense Department and try to get somebody new in the job to replace Dr. Esper as the defense secretary. Is there any precedence for that having happened? And how on earth would that even work if, right, there is a change in administration? Like, if he's staying, then everybody understands. And obviously, everybody serves at the discretion and favor of the president. But how would that work if he's leaving office? Is there any chance that that job gets filled by somebody else for a month or 6 weeks?
As you indicated, all political appointees serve at the pleasure of the president. And, you know, there have been cabinet officials that have been let go by a president. President Carter and his Secretary of State parted ways on not amicable terms. And there have been others. Certainly, Secretary Rumsfeld was replaced by Secretary Gates in the November-December timeframe. So we have had that occur in the waning days of a session of Congress. But it would really depend if President
But it Trump, wasn't the waning of an administration, right?
Well, here's what I was getting ready to cover is that, let's say Trump is not reelected and he still wants Secretary Esper to move on. He could fill that position under the Vacancy Act. Somebody else that's been already confirmed could come in under the Vacancy Act. If he's leaving office on January 20th, the Senate is not going to confirm a replacement. So if he has a vacancy and wants to put somebody in that job, although the deputy under the Title 10 could be the acting Secretary of Defense, just like Pat Shanahan was after Secretary Mattis left. If the president is reelected and he decides to change, then the Senate could basically determine the timeline for confirming a new Secretary of Defense. As indicated, we've had one confirmed in a December timeframe, or they could wait till the new Congress. So it takes two to basically run the confirmation process. But again, under the Vacancy Act, the president can fill a vacancy for a certain period of time. So, obviously I'm not in a position to know what the president may or may not do. But as I indicated, there are only really two options here.
Michael, yeah, anything you want to add?
No, I'd say, Vago, it's just, if it happened, it would be very unusual, but it certainly isn't unconstitutional or illegal. It's all within the powers of the presidency.
Gentlemen, thanks so very much for joining us. We appreciate it. We look forward to you guys joining us on a weekly basis every Friday for a little bit of a transition update and how to think of about major issues along the way. Arnold, Michael, thanks so much and looking forward to having you guys back on.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.